This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents I'll Be Your Blue Sky, a novel by Marisa De Los Santos, performed by Angela Daw and Aaron Bennett. For Jennifer Carlson, friend and agent who loved Claire Hobbs from the very beginning.
Chapter 1. Edith. June 1950. It was what she would remember always, how the second she stepped inside, before she'd so much as taken her first full breath of new air, she was struck by the feeling, the understanding, the certainty, however improbable, that the house was Joseph. Not merely that it felt like something he would choose, or that she saw his handiwork everywhere, fresh paint, thick as cream, refinished pine floors, green apples in a glass bowl, but that it was him, sturdy and open, light swooping in through every window, forthright and decent and kind. She would not have supposed that a house could be kind, but this one was. It smelled like sawdust and lemon oil and reckless salt wind. The tile countertop was pale green edged in black. In the next room, two chairs, modern ones made of curved rosewood and with square gold cushions, faced the fireplace. Three tall windows ran along the back wall, each a lambent rectangle of outside world, emerald yard, iris sky, and a platinum flash that Joseph said was a canal leading out into the bay. Edith stood still and straight in her going-away suit, even though they'd gone only a few miles down the road, and let herself be held by the house, like a firefly cupped between two careful hands. She felt Joseph waiting behind her, halfway inside the door, one foot on the smooth floor, one on the gray-painted boards of the front porch. He had not carried her over the threshold, knowing she would prefer to walk in and to see the place, for just this first time, alone. They'd been married 2 hours earlier in a centuries-old tiny country church with a clear Palladian window overlooking a bean field, a view Edith would not have expected to be beautiful but was, the breeze threading like fingers through the low rows of ruffled leaves. Edith would have married Joseph in the middle of that field, or barefoot on the sand dunes, or on a street corner with taxis honking their horns. She would have married him in her oldest dress. But as she'd stood in that church, she had been grateful to be in white lace, her skirt belled like the Campanula carpatica flowers from her childhood backyard. The dress, the window, the chapel's vaulted ceiling, the quiet voice of the rector, and Joseph's mother, radiant in her pew, smiling and weeping at the same time. All of it kindled the moment into something bright and splendid. All Edith needed was him, of course, but Joseph deserved splendor. His mother, Anne, was the only wedding guest. Although Joseph's friends could have filled the church and spilled out into the churchyard, into the old cemetery with its tilted stones, into the bean field. But he'd known that she would have no one, her father gone, her few close friends scattered far and wide. He hadn't even wanted his mother there for fear his bride, though long accustomed to motherlessness, would feel her father's absence. He'd been dead 10 months, even more keenly. But Edith had insisted on his mother. Anne had loved Joseph unflaggingly his whole life, had written him a letter every day he'd been in Europe photographing the war, and even after, when he'd stayed to, as he put it, tidy up. It seemed only just that she bear witness. More than just. The thing was impossible without her. Edith explored the house, which was larger than she'd expected, bigger than most of the surrounding bayside cottages in this Delaware seaside town, a place Joseph had visited for a week as a child the summer before his father died and had never forgotten. On the first floor, in addition to the kitchen and living room, there was a small bedroom and bath and a large closet that Joseph, with the help of a plumber, had converted into a dark room. Upstairs, there were two more bedrooms, one big enough to serve double duty as an office, another bathroom, this one with an enormous clawfoot tub, and a small sitting room with a sofa and a squatty black wood stove polished to a shine. Up a narrow flight of stairs was Joseph and Edith's bedroom. Sun sifting drowsily through windows hung with rose bouquet printed bark cloth, a bed taking up most of the room, an oval braided rag rug on the wide plank floor at its foot. And everywhere hydrangeas, enough to make Edith gasp, great bunches billowing from vases on every surface, deep pink on one dresser, Luna moth green on the other, light blue and mauve lace cap on the antique writing desk, a single heavy purple pom-pom nodding from the sink in the bathroom, and next to the bed, a bouquet of bridal white. Edith smiled at the memory of Joseph early that morning, marching into the hotel restaurant with his shirt sleeves rolled up, gardening gloves stuffed into the pocket of his pants, and a sly smile. He had refused to explain his whereabouts, but now she imagined him at daybreak, clipping blooms, maybe even purloining them from people's yards, striding around town with armfuls of flowers, loading up his car with every shade of sunrise to decorate this room at the top of their house. The house had been part of the proposal.
"I found us a home, Edie. And now you really have to marry me so we can go live in it."
"We could live in it anyway," she'd said, tracing the outline of his lips with her forefinger. "We could be a tremendous scandal." He had laughed and kissed her and told her all about it. About the house, but also the canals, a network of them, like streets made of water. Tranquil except for the occasional leaping fish or tiny, pulsing, gossamer sea nettle, barely there, a scrap of living creature like a floating whisper. About the salt marshes and inland bays and, of course, the ocean.
"You and I have seen too much these past few years, Edie. You with losing your dad, me with the war and the tidying up afterward. We need fresh air, open water, sun rising out of the ocean every evening. We need the ocean, Edie. Can you imagine it?"
She just about could, but she had to ask, "I can see being there most of the year, but what about winter? A beach town might be especially dreary in winter, with freezing wind coming off the water and gray, gray skies. What will we do then?" Edith shut her eyes, dropped backward onto the bed, and remembered Joseph's face when she'd asked that question, surprised and bemused, his brow furrowed, as if the answer were obvious.
"Why, I'll be your blue sky," he'd said.
What could she do? What could anyone do with a man like that but marry him and live in his house near the ocean? For a moment, her eyes still shut, Edith lay on her back in the center of her marriage bed inside the house that was Joseph. Down to the banisters and the light switches and the fat stove and the writing desk, slender-legged as a cat, listening to the house, breathing in the clean perfume of it. And then she opened her eyes and, for the first time, saw that the ceiling was painted sky blue with here and there a wisp of white cloud, and she was certain that there had never been so much gratitude in the history of the world. From down below, she heard a faint whine, which she knew must be the back door opening, so she jumped up off the bed to look out the center window. Joseph stood on the back lawn at the edge of the canal, his hands in his pockets, his wedding jacket slung over one arm. Edith tugged open the window and called out, "Joseph!" He spun around and stared up at her, his face breaking into a broad smile.
"Hey!" he shouted.
"Oh, my darling Joseph. Thank you." It came out hoarse, too hushed for him to hear, so she cleared her throat and sang it. "Thank you!" He opened out his arms and said,
"Look at all this. Ours. Can you believe it?"
"Yes," she said, laughing. "Yes, I can."
"Come down, Edie. Come down and see the rest."
"Oh, my darling," she whispered once more before she wiped her eyes, kicked off her shoes, shimmied out of her stockings, and ran down to where he waited.
Chapter 2. Claire. Until Cornelia piped up with, "You know what, I never liked that iris either. I mean, it was pretty enough, but bad. A truly bad, bad, low-down, dirty, and despicable iris. I was so busy composing a mental list of 10 reasons to marry Zack that I hadn't even noticed I was shredding the poor thing to bits. Shredding the iris, I mean, not Zack. Although, I suppose you could argue that while frantically racking my brain for reasons to marry a man I was promised and slated to marry within 30 hours wasn't exactly ripping him to pieces, it wasn't exactly nice either. In fact, I was fairly positive that it would break his heart if he knew. Especially since I got stuck after reason 9. We, my mother Viviana, my almost-mother Cornelia Brown, and I, were making centerpieces at an outdoor table at the resort Zack had found for our wedding. A pearly, columned, historic dreamboat of a hotel sailing atop an oak and pine-studded crest of Blue Ridge. Purple mophead hydrangeas and lithe white irises listed in buckets at our feet. A swimming pool stretched out graciously before us, a fountain like a great hibiscus blossom sprouting from its center, and a swimming pool-colored sky smiled dotingly down. Zack had texted the weather forecast to me the night before. 3 straight days of 72-degree highs, cloudless skies, and 0 humidity. Nice weather by any standard, by June in southwestern Virginia standards, a minor meteorological miracle. Perfect wedding weather, which should have made me perfectly giddy. Instead, I found it unsettling, even creepy. "What is this, Stepford, Connecticut? Brigadoon? Commissats?" I'd grumbled to myself during my post-breakfast, French toast decorated with edible flowers, walk around the grounds. "Where's the humidity? Where are the damned mosquitoes?" I dropped the rags of iris onto the tabletop, stared down at my hands, which were sticky as a murderer's, and sighed. It wasn't that it was hard to think up reasons why anyone would want to marry Zack. He was so generally, generically marriageable, it was almost funny. Handsome, smart, hardworking, a law school star from a wealthy family, no criminal record, good manners, naturally curly hair. A golden boy if ever I'd seen one. Wheat-colored curls, tawny brows and lashes, eyes the color of India pale ale. Even his car was gold. The man was a bona fide catch. Give him a chaise and 4, an estate, and £10,000 a year, and any Austin heroine would go stumbling over the countryside in her Regency heels to get to him. No. If my task had been to list reasons why anyone should marry Zack, I could have reeled them off lickety-split and mangled no flowers in the process. But here at what was surely the 11th hour, God, 11th and a half, I was hell-bent on coming up with reasons why I should. A different matter entirely. My mother dunked a paper towel into one of the flower buckets and handed it to me. I scrubbed zealously at my palms as Cornelia and my mother looked on.
"Something on your mind, Lady Macbeth?" Cornelia said.
She reached out and tugged on the paper towel until I relinquished it. I shrugged. "Guess I'm just a little nervous." "Completely normal," said my mother briskly.
"Oh, yes," Cornelia said, nodding. "Classic, even. Pre-wedding jitters, cold feet. Absolutely everyone gets them."
"Did you?" I asked. Cornelia suddenly became occupied with poking a single iris into a hillock of hydrangea, narrowing her eyes, positioning the flower just so.
"You didn't, did you?" I asked. "Oh, well, gosh, I..."
"Cornelia..." She gave me an apologetic smile and shook her head.
"Nope. I was actually even a little impatient."
"A little?" said my mother with a snort. "I know it was over a decade ago, but I seem to remember you're trying to browbeat Teo into eloping with you even after you two had set a date and signed the catering contract."
I laughed. For my professional party planner mother, the catering contract marked the point of no return.
"I may have done that, once or twice." Cornelia laughed. Per day, every day leading up to our wedding, including at our rehearsal dinner. But I'd known him since I was 4 years old. It was time to get that show on the road. What about you, Mom? Jitters?
Oh, not with Gordon, but remember, I was 20 years older than you are now. With my marriage to your father, though, God, yes, jitters upon jitters.
Your marriage to my father lasted all of 3 years, I pointed out.
3 years and 9 months, actually. I just kicked him out after three.
Oh, much better. Very reassuring. Simultaneously, my mother's and Cornelia's faces softened into looks of concern. Oh, those two women. Suddenly, all I wanted in the world was to sit there with them, blessed by the beam of their gaze, watching the sun glance off their glossy heads of hair and tucking flowers into other flowers all day. Or for the next 3 days. Or for a lifetime. Sit, bless, beam, glance, tuck. Yes, a lifetime would be good.
Darling, said my mother quietly, do you need reassuring?
Just as Cornelia reached across the table and pressed her hand over mine.
Of course not,
I said, my eyes filling with tears.
It's just...
A sob snagged in my throat.
It's all right, said my mother. Whatever it is, it's all right.
Of course it is, sweetheart, said Cornelia. Never fear.
I planted my elbows on the picnic table and covered my face with my hands.
Please,
I said from behind my hands.
Just...
What? Said Cornelia.
We'll do anything.
I flapped my hand in their direction.
Talk!
I squeaked.
About what?
Asked my mother.
Anything!
We sat, tinsel threads of birdsong drifting and tangling in the air around us. Finally, Cornelia said,
I'm calling it. Time of death, 9:41 a.m.
Through a gap in my fingers, I saw her holding the remains of the iris. She lifted it to her nose.
Well, that's interesting, Viviana, she said.
What?
Asked my mother.
This flower has been lacerated, mutilated, has suffered devastating internal injuries.
And external, supplied my mother.
Profound external injuries, agreed Cornelia.
She was twisting it, observed my mother, in addition to ripping it.
I saw, said Cornelia. The thing is horribly injured and irreversibly dead, and yet it still smells lovely.
Like jellyfish.
Precisely, said Cornelia.
Even when they're dead and washed up on the beach, they'd sting you as soon as look at you.
They would.
Oh, and what about that mad dog in To Kill a Mockingbird,
said my mother.
The one Atticus shoots and then says is
just as dangerous dead as alive,
finished Cornelia grimly. Through my fingers, I watched her nod.
Actually, I looked that up once.
I thought maybe you had.
And what I discovered is that the rabies virus can live on for months in the body of a dead animal in freezing temperatures.
But it never gets that cold in Alabama, said my mother skeptically.
Cornelia smacked the tabletop.
Exactly what I said to myself. Alabama is such a warm state that it isn't even that cold in February, which is when Atticus shot the dog. However, even in warm temperatures, the virus can live for hours and can be transmitted as long as the saliva is still wet.
Saliva is such an unappealing word. And I wouldn't say that that accounts for the statement that the dog was as dangerous dead as it had been when it was alive and staggering toward them down the street.
No, but I suspect Atticus exaggerated in the interest of protecting his children.
That would be just like him,
said my mother.
Oh, and then there's the praying mantis.
Ah, yes, said Cornelia with relish, shifting into a nature show narrator's voice. During the mating act, the female savagely bites the head off the male, and undaunted by his headless state, he continues to thrust. Okay, I said.
I took my hands away from my face. Cornelia handed me a paper towel and I dabbed at my eyes.
Was that possibly not the best example to bring up at the moment?
Asked my mother. I smiled.
I'm physically incapable of laughing right now, but I do appreciate the effort.
We sat together in the lemony morning light, not speaking, my mother and Cornelia with their hands clasped on the tabletop, the centerpiece making temporarily suspended, and for one lovely, breathing moment, everything felt suspended, as if we three, the bird song,
The crisp, weightless air and the wealth of flowers hung outside of time, so that it wasn't the day before my wedding or any day. No irrevocable catering contracts, no hordes of guests arriving in waves over the next 24 hours, no gifts amassing like tires in a junkyard. A tall, thin, elderly woman in a loose chambray dress and green gardening clogs walked by. Leaning on a cane, with a book tucked under her free arm, she navigated carefully across the grass, her eyes on the ground, and then just as she got to where we sat, she raised her head, her white hair starry as dandelion fluff in the morning sun, and smiled at me.
"Courage, dear heart,"
she said in a ringing, surprisingly young-sounding voice, then dropped her eyes and walked on. We all watched her go, patient step after patient step.
"Thank you,"
I called out to her. She paused, shifted her book to her other arm, and raised her fist in solidarity. Once she disappeared, my mother and Cornelia stared at me, questioningly. "The Voyage of the Dawn Treader," I said.
"What?"
said my mother.
"Oh," said Cornelia. "Aslan!"
"When he comes to Lucy in the form of an albatross," I said.
"Courage, dear heart," is what he tells her.
"Good grief, how you loved those books,"
said my mother. The gardening clog woman's voice came back to me, silver as a tossed coin.
"Courage, dear heart."
Courage.
Courage.
Fine.
Who was I to disobey Aslan?
"I was making a list," I explained, and once I'd eked out those first five words, the rest came tumbling faster and faster. "I'm not proud of it, but I honestly thought it would be easy. That's why I started it, because if it were as easy as I thought it was going to be, I'd know we'd be okay. I guess it was kind of a test. God, that sounds awful. Not like a math test or a trial, more like, what's it called, litmus. Oh, still bad, I know. The point is, I expected the reasons to just stack up neatly, click, click, click. But then I got stuck, and even some of the items I was dead sure about seemed, I don't know, flimsy. But the worst part is that the more I worked on the list, the more I realized how terribly, awfully much was riding on it, which is so wrong and stupid. The whole thing reeks of betrayal, not only making the list, not only not being able to finish it, but being desperate to finish it. Because I've already said yes, and this ship is smack in the middle of the ocean, no getting off, and Zack's a good person. He deserves better than a stupid list or than a fiancé who would make one. And listen to me, I can hardly even get my mouth around the word fiancé. What in God's name will I do with wife?"
I stopped, panting and hot-faced, panic charging at me from every direction. I braced myself for the bone-shaking impact of it, but before it arrived, my mother and Cornelia exchanged one glance, blue eyes locked on brown. The tiniest movement, but you could almost hear the thunderclap of it, feel the earth shift on its axis, their forces joining on my behalf.
"You're a natural list maker, Claire. As soon as you could write, lists, lists, lists,"
said my mother calmly.
"It's who you are."
"But this is different,"
I said.
"Would you like to share the list with us?"
said Cornelia.
"Now?"
"As if another time would be more fitting."
"You don't have to, but it might help to haul that puppy out of your head and into the world. We can swear to reserve all judgment if you like."
Cornelia lifted her right hand and slapped the left onto an imaginary Bible. My mother did the same.
"Maybe I want judgment," I said, twisting my hair. "I can't tell. I've lost perspective."
"We can play the judgment by ear," said my mother. "Judgment as needed."
"Well, the items are in no particular order,"
I warned.
"So much the better," said Cornelia.
"Wait," said my mother. "Just to clarify, what is this a list of exactly?"
"It's a list of 10 reasons why I specifically, not just anyone, but specifically I, Claire Hobbs, should marry Zack."
"Got it,"
said my mother.
"Shoot."
"Let him rip,"
said Cornelia. I cleared my throat.
"One, he makes a perfect egg over easy."
A goofy flutter of a laugh escaped me.
"I told you they were in no particular order."
"Oh, I don't know about that. Over easy is your favorite,"
said my mother.
"And he stripes them with sriracha,"
I said.
"Stripes,"
said Cornelia.
"How incredibly thoughtful."
"Two, he really, really wants me to. Zack wants me to marry him more than anyone has ever wanted anything from me in my life."
"Are you sure?"
asked Cornelia, solemnly and as if she had someone specific in mind. I could guess who the someone might be, and for a second I faltered.
Zack says he will never have a happy day for the rest of his life if we aren't together. Not I can't imagine having a happy day, but I will never have a happy day, with his total assurance. No one has ever said that to me.
Ah, said Cornelia. Yes, I can see how maybe no one would have.
Three. Anytime he goes to someone's house or apartment, he takes a gift. And I'm not just talking about to fancy dinners, but on any occasion. Baseball watching parties, study sessions, board game nights, drop by for a beer kind of occasions. And not just flowers or a bottle of wine, but action figures, a funny t-shirt, a copy of The New Yorker with a post-it marking an especially good article, a giant bag of gumballs, a garden gnome.
How completely adorable, said my mother, and Cornelia clapped her hands. What I did not add was that I knew what all the gifts were because about a month after we'd begun dating, Zack had mostly stopped going places without me. If he were invited over to a friend's house, he would ask me to come, and if I declined, he'd smile, shrug, and stay with me. And if I were invited somewhere, he would ask to come along so charmingly that I would forget how to say no. Eventually, because it was just easier, I accepted it all, asking people ahead of time if he could come, saying yes to him even when I was tired or had too much homework or loathed watching baseball. I always loathed watching baseball. My friend Hildy declared it hideously dysfunctional and took to kidnapping me, sneaking up on me at the library or as I was coming out of a class and whisking me off to a restaurant or a bar or to her apartment. I felt bad about not telling Zack, worse about outright lying to him, but time alone with Hildy was far beyond a guilty pleasure. It ranked up there with food and sunlight and books.
Four. He sincerely tries to reduce his carbon footprint. He has a low-emission car but rides his bike or walks whenever possible, even in the freezing cold. Checks his tire inflation obsessively, drives no more than 5 miles over the speed limit ever, even on the highway, never eats beef, consumes only locally produced food. He actually taught himself how to can.
Amazing, said my mother.
Impressive, said Cornelia. Although I do worry about botulism.
I didn't say that no matter how a conversation with Zack about climate change began, fracking, Hummers, a documentary on polar bears, there being no sadder sight on Earth than a starving polar bear, all baggy skin, huge paws, and haunted eyes. It would end with an exhortation to save the world for our future children, and their children's children, my stomach backflipping harder with each generation. Zack, with his long line of offspring, conga dancing relentlessly into the future, well, I could not for the life of me, not after an extraordinarily good day with him or a few glasses of wine, envision even a single baby.
Five. If we're in a fight, he won't walk away or go to bed or hang up until it's resolved.
Oh, that's a good one, said my mother. Going to bed mad is wretched, like trying to sleep with sand in your sheets or with a possible gas leak in your boiler.
I had to laugh at this. Only my mother would equate the risk of death by carbon monoxide with the discomfort of sand.
I agree, I said.
Who could ever marry someone who would let a fight just dangle there overnight?
Cornelia raised her hand.
I did.
You're kidding, I said.
Teo? But he's the best person in the world.
It was the God's honest truth.
Yes, but he believes in the restorative power of silence, walking away for a while, calming down, looking inward, Cornelia said. Which is obviously incredibly annoying.
Someone should smack him,
growled my mother.
Don't think I haven't come close. More than that, though, he's got this faith.
In God? I asked.
In us, which seems to amount to the same thing for him.
Cornelia rolled her eyes.
He trusts in our ability to weather any storm so much that sometimes he actually forgets we're fighting. He'll just walk into a room where I'm fuming and start telling me a story about how it's so windy that he just watched our neighbor chase his trash can lid all the way down the street. And I start laughing and forget that I loathe him and everything he stands for.
The rat bastard,
said my mother.
Poor Cornelia, I said.
Number six.
Zack never tailgates, ever, no matter how slowly the car in front of him is going.
Because the driver in front of you could be anyone, an organ donor, a war hero,
a man who's just lost his best friend.
A kid with a new license doing her best, said Cornelia. Not tailgating acknowledges the mystery and humanity of strangers. It's one of those small habits that speaks volumes.
Like how someone treats waiters, said my mother.
That was number 7, I said.
Well, bravo, Zach, said my mother.
8. He laughs at my jokes.
Huge, said Cornelia.
Colossal, immeasurable. 9. He sings all the time, even though he has a horrific voice.
Lovely, my mother pronounced.
Really? I said. Not a little flimsy?
He's at home in his own skin, said my mother. Nothing flimsy about that.
I knew what she meant, but I also knew if I were honest with myself, and when it came to Zach, it seemed I could be somewhat less than absolutely honest. Including his singing on my list mostly qualified as wishful thinking. I might have declared it the exception that proved the rule, although I've never been sure enough about the meaning of that phrase to employ it with confidence. But in any case, despite his goodness and goldenness and aforementioned obvious marriageability, Zach had never struck me as comfortable being Zach. Taut, edgy, a man of fidgeting hands and rustling energy, he was the kind of person who said something and then watched for your reaction, ready to revise, rephrase, backtrack, but so deftly that you might not even notice. And that's where I got stuck, I said. Hence the iris.
A good, solid list nonetheless, declared my mother.
I know, I said. And good and solid was, well, good.
Also solid.
What it wasn't was luminous, or transcendent. But I didn't say this out loud.
It's true that 9 isn't 10, observed Cornelia. But it almost is.
Oh!
My mother pointed at me with both fingers.
The book thing!
A shiver crept over my arms. I knew exactly what she meant.
The thing he does with the books, expanded my mother. The thing you told me about.
Zach does something with books and you forgot to put it on your list? Said Cornelia. That doesn't sound like you, Claire.
I didn't forget, I said.
No.
My mother tipped her blonde head to the side and eyed me. Whenever he sees me reading a book, I said slowly, he buys it and reads it too.
So you can talk about it together, said my mother. Share in the experience.
But one glance at Cornelia's face told me she understood.
Every book? She asked quietly. When you don't ask him to?
I nodded and watched the same shiver that had crawled up my arms ripple over her scalp. She slid her fingers through her boy-cropped hair.
What? Said my mother.
I don't know, I said. It's hard to explain.
The inside of a book is a private space, said Cornelia. Someone barging in uninvited is...
She shivered again.
Every book, really?
Sometimes I hide them from him, I confessed. I stick them in the trunk of my car, in the spare tire compartment, and go get them only when he's not around.
Of course you do, she said, waggling the ruined iris contemplatively. And he wants to talk to you about them afterward? All of them?
I don't have the heart to tell him no, I said. He's just so, eager.
Dogged is what I'd almost said. Obsessive.
Not so much to tell me what he thinks or to argue, but to know what I think. In detail. He asks question after question. Sometimes...
Sometimes what?
Asked my mother. Sometimes I think he won't be satisfied until he climbs inside my head and lives there. My laugh after I said it sounded limping and fake even to me, and when I got my nerve up to look at Cornelia and my mother, I could tell they weren't fooled either. Worry bracketed my mother's eyes and mouth, while Cornelia's expression bordered on horrified.
You know what, though?
My mother said at last.
I'll bet he has no idea that he's barging into your inner life and leaving his footprints all over it.
I'll bet he's just trying to be nice.
I'm trying too hard, obviously, or going about it the wrong way, but still truly trying.
And whoosh, there it was. Number 10, bursting out of the darkness. Hallelujah.
That's it,
I cried, and threw my arms into the air in a V for victory.
Number 10, said my mother.
It's an essential fact of Zach, I said. Which is maybe why I overlooked it the first time around. It's too obvious. I mean, I'd never claim to know what the central, essential fact of another person was, because that's overstepping. But if I ever did decide to make a claim like that, I'd say his is this. He tries so hard to be good. A tiny pause riddled with birdsong. Then, said my mother.
Well, there you go.
Good is good,
said Cornelia.
List complete!
They were the very picture of cheerful supportiveness, their inflection, the corners of Cornelia's twinkling cat's eyes, and of my mother's crescent moon smile, all tipping appropriately upward. But I knew their faces. If I had a list of faces I knew best in the world, theirs would make the top five, and what I read in them now was concern.
Okay, I said, sighing. Just say it.
It's only that, well, said Cornelia.
Does he have to try very hard?
Yes, I said. But that's what makes it so beautiful. It's hard, and he does it anyway. I told you how his mother died when he was a baby, and he grew up with that horrible father. Sorry to speak ill of the dead, but the man was a nightmare. And that mean older brother, I mean, even his uncles and cousins are awful. All those cold, stone-faced, judgmental men. Can you even imagine growing up like that?
It sounds difficult, said my mother.
Beyond difficult, I said. It warps you. Wait, that sounds bad. Zack isn't warped, but goodness has to be something he chooses. It's not a knee-jerk no-brainer for him, the way it is for people who grew up loved every second of their lives. I heard the note of contempt in my voice. Contempt for the consistently loved, the thoughtlessly thoughtful, and even in my worked-up state, I knew I couldn't let that stand. My voice went tender. And yes, I'm one of those people, and I'm grateful. To both of you especially, and to Teo and Gordon and everyone else. All I mean is that goodness might not always be Zack's first impulse, and sometimes he gets it wrong, but he always feels terrible afterward and scrambles to make up for his mistakes.
Does he often get it wrong?
Asked my mother evenly.
I flashed on his face, still and shadow-carved, his eyes flat as glass, a shut-up like a slap, mean laugh scything toward me out of nowhere.
Not often at all, I said, and he's so sorry afterward.
All right, but about his having to try so hard.
Now don't get mad, began Cornelia.
I just want to understand. Wouldn't it be easier
to be with someone effortlessly kind and good, I said.
Well, even naturally kind people struggle with it sometimes, said Cornelia. But yes.
Don't you see, though? I love how much he wants to be different from the rest of his family. He could so easily have gone down the same road as the others, but he refused. He refuses all the time, every day, as best he can. That takes courage, I think, to fight what comes easiest to you. And he says I make him want to try even more.
Cornelia stood up, walked around behind me, looped her scrawny arms around me, and held on hard.
Oh, darling Claire, girl made of sunshine. Of course you do.
I held on back. Cornelia was a tiny person, with a little angled face and child's wrists. One of my hands covered both of hers. But when she held you, you felt instantly stronger, and also like a bird in a nest.
His sister disappearing the way she did, said my mother, shaking her head. That kind of loss changes a family forever.
When Zack was 10, on a summer night, his tempest-haired, shimmering, rebellious 18-year-old sister, Rosalie called Roe, who had been his only mother for most of his life, vanished from their family's house in northern Michigan. No note, no goodbyes, not even a fight with her father to explain her disappearance, even though there had been many, many fights before that. Just her car parked at the lip of the inland lake near their summer house, the water lapping the front tires, the keys still in the ignition. Local police investigated, dredging the lake while Zack looked on, a fact I had been horrified to learn. But they never found Ro. Everyone assumed she had run away to California, a place she'd never visited but worshipped, plastering the walls of her room with photos of beaches and deserts, the Hollywood sign, the Golden Gate Bridge, or else had gotten drunk and drowned in some other body of water, of which there were many nearby. And once the authorities had given up the search, despite his virtually unlimited resources, financial and otherwise, Zack's father had refused to look for her, or to allow anyone else to look for her. She'll come home when she's hungry, he said. But she never did. And Zack's older brother Ian, their father, and the rest of the family simply erased her, until eventually no one even said her name, not in front of their father or anywhere else. Zack's father wrote her out of his will, paid a stranger to box up and give away her belongings, disappeared her as surely as if he'd lit a match and burned her right out of the family picture.
I'd immediately assumed it was because he was heartbroken at the loss of her, but Zack said no. That was giving the man credit for heart he didn't have. She was the bad, ungrateful child. The family was better off, his father said. Still, I understood that her absence, that smoking, black-edged, wild child-shaped hole, was at the center of all their lives. His father was pretty gruesome even before, but Zack thinks there might have been hope for his brother Ian if she'd stayed. Now there's only hope for him, I said. Then added, a lot of hope, though. At least, I think so.
I'll bet you're right, sweetheart, said my mother.
So? Said Cornelia. List complete?
I nodded. My mother waggled my poor broken-down iris.
Pay your last respects and let's get back to these everlasting centerpieces.
Adios, Iris, I said, and my mother tossed it over her shoulder.
Now then, she said, taking up a centerpiece in progress. Just to refresh your memories, you put a few spikes of iris into each hydrangea bouquet, placing the irises so that they stick up a bit from the hydrangeas, as if the white flowers are butterflies that have just landed on the purple. If you stick the irises too deeply into the hydrangeas, all will be lost.
All? I asked, smiling.
All, said my mother sternly. So remember, butterfly effect.
And boom, there he was, with his sudden white smile and careless hair, casting his rangy shadow across the picnic table. Devereaux Tremaine, Cornelia's science-loving stepson, my friend for the past 4 years, my boyfriend for the 5 years before that, although boyfriend had always felt like too fluffy a word for what Dev had been to me. Starting at the age of 13, I had loved him so truly and easily and thoroughly that for 5 years, in love with Dev was my ordinary state. And it was only later when we shifted, jarringly, painfully, to friendship, that I recognized it as a state of grace. We were 15 the first time he tried to explain chaos theory to me. It was late June of the first entire summer I spent at Cornelia and Teo's house in Wilmington, Delaware. I'd spent chunks of summers at their house before, along with some spring and fall breaks, and at Christmas time they would drive to Virginia, where I lived with my mother in the same neighborhood as Cornelia's and Teo's parents. Cornelia had come into my life when I was 11, although it's far more accurate to say that I came into hers. Fell. Plummeted. A stunned, reeling, heartbroken child, plunging headlong and out of nowhere into her urban single-woman life of coffee shops and black-and-white movies and late nights whirling with witty conversation, and whom, without questioning or even stopping to think, she had reached out and caught. In the space of a few days, my bipolar mother had had a breakdown, and my estranged father had died. And reflexively, Cornelia pulled love around me like a coat, tugged it shut and did up the buttons, as if I belonged to her. And so I did. Dev did, too, to her and to Teo, the father he'd discovered when he was 13. Between Dev and his mother Lake, Cornelia and Teo, Cornelia's and Teo's parents, their brothers and sisters, my mother and me, we were a family. A sprawling, messy, glorious one, expanding like a galaxy over the years to include my stepfather Gordon, Lake's boyfriend Bruno, Cornelia's brother Toby's wife Ella, Cornelia's brother Cam's husband Niall, and all manner of scrumptious children, including Toby's son Jasper, Cornelia's sister Ollie's son Charlie, and Cornelia and Teo's children, Rose and Simon, whom I loved beyond description. That first full summer at Cornelia's house returns to me in sparkling scraps, sensory flashes, backyard nights needle-pricked with fireflies, clunk of a basketball, my hands sliding under Dev's t-shirt and up his back, chit-chit-chit of a sprinkler, the fragrance of sunscreen, citronella, chlorine on Dev's skin, slap of playing cards on porch boards, the little matching valleys above Dev's collarbones, shaving of moon resting on a rooftop, Dev's slate-blue eyes, lumpy ground under my shoulder blades, my hand in Dev's while the Perseid streaked to the sky, and Dev at Cornelia's kitchen table explaining chaos theory, the butterfly effect, his hands tracing the sensitive dependence on initial conditions in the air, his face the most alive thing I'd ever seen. It's why I'd ask him about it, to see his face do that. But after a while, I fell hard for the idea itself, and for weeks afterward saw large and distant consequences in every slight motion, Butterfly wings, yes, but also the flick of a squirrel's tail. The snap of a branch under my foot. Dev's quick, over-the-shoulder glance at me when we rode our bikes. That Dev could brush my bare shoulder with his mouth and kick up wild weather years and miles away felt equal parts amazing and inevitable. We weren't in love anymore, but the thought of my friend Dev worked its own miniature butterfly effect, took the tension out of my backbone, and the day was suddenly not creepily picture-perfect, but exactly the right amount of nice. I shut my eyes and felt the whole of the blue sky unfurling like a sheet under my breastbone. When I opened my eyes, Cornelia was smiling at me.
"The sensitive dependence on initial conditions," she said. "He always lost me at the math. But until then, I was right there with him."
"So was I said.
Chapter 3. Edith. October 1949. It wasn't the presence of dead, beautiful things that broke her. Nor was it those glass eyes, pair after lightless pair. It wasn't even the fact that her father would have worshipped this place, would have stood in the octagonal rotunda, hat pressed to heart, shy and devout as a pilgrim. She had only to close her eyes to see him there. Sun, swirled with galaxies of dust, falling like snow through the domed ceiling's oculus. No, what did it? Knocked the breath from her body were the labels. Humble white rectangles in glass display cases, each offering its tiny, hard-won piece of truth. The common and binomial names of the bit of life next to it. Iridescent beetle, dried fern, moth, fat-bodied, wings decked with eyes, and the date and location of its finding. It was October. In March, her father had suffered his first stroke. His neighbor, Gladys Polk, had found him lying on his side on the shore, his sketchbook ruined, his slack right cheek pressed into the spring thaw mud, and Edith had left her nursing job in Pittsburgh to move back into the little house in Connecticut, near Long Island Sound. He'd had the second stroke in June, more ravaging than the first. In mid-August, he had died, not peacefully. And yes, it was the end of suffering, the end of weakness, drooling, spoon-feedings, and, so much worse than all the rest, his wild-eyed, fruitless clawing after words and memories. But, to her shock, the end of all this brought Edith nothing but intractable pain. She imagined she felt like a person struck by lightning. Worse than the grief was her shame that she couldn't even be relieved for him, a state of affairs that didn't last only because, eventually, nothing was worse than the grief. It became everything, every waking minute, if she could be said to be awake, of every day, an arid, tearless, terrible morning. She never left the house, slogging from room to room through the thick fog of quiet. Sometimes it choked her physically, the absolute lack of her father's footsteps, his voice, although really the house was hardly quieter than during all the years they had lived in it, just the two of them. A slow-moving, deliberate, soft-spoken man with a hungry mind, a child who shadowed him, asking questions. He had been a high school biology teacher, a good one, but she'd always known his heart wasn't in the classroom. It was in the marshes and woods surrounding their house, in mosses and skeletons, nests and tracks, calls and songs. They could spend an hour watching dragonflies, the hovering and darting, the sudden exquisite hairpin turns, her father explaining in a near whisper how each of the four wings is controlled by separate muscles. He taught her how to use the net, the killing jar, how to spread and pin and label. Schmidt boxes with hinged lids were stacked in every room, meticulously organized. Every bit of it felt holy. But it was the labeling she most cherished. She stayed still while he wrote, her breath held in a prayer that his hand would be steady, the tiny printing clean and clear. She recognized these moments for what they were. Love, What else but love? Love in the painstaking handwriting. Love in his recitation of the Latin names and her solemn echoing of them, their own private call and response. Love, too, in walking through the woods, squatting side by side at a tidal pool. Love, oh, so much, in his teaching her how to put together a crow's skeleton, the reverent naming of the parts, her fingers handling the precious hollow bones. One day in September, a month after she'd buried him, Edith failed for an hour to inflate her lungs properly, as if she'd used up all the air in the house, so she tore open the front door and reeled out into the daylight, heart banging, chest burning, thoughts unspooled. An hour's walk along the shoreline, every stone and reed and bird track an affront, the sheen on the water brutal as a punch, and she knew without doubt that it was possible to die of grief. Acting on pure instinct, she ran back to the house and cleaned it from top to bottom, a task that took a week. She organized and packed away her father's papers without reading them, her father's clothes without so much as pressing a shirt to her cheek. The refrigerator alone, ripe with rotting food, took hours. Scrubbing left her hands raw and cramped, her knees black and blue, but it reminded her that she was a body instead of just a ransacked heart and a flailing brain, and if she did not exactly want to live, she at least wanted to stay alive, to walk upright, keep the blood fanning its steady current through her veins. Not to be dead just yet was as far as her hope could reach, but it was something. That night, Edith called Doris Cole, a nurse she knew who had taken a job at a hospital in Washington. Edith did not particularly want Washington or Doris, but all that mattered was getting away. She didn't want a job either, at least not immediately. She would sell her father's house, her only inheritance, and everything in it. She would donate to her father's school the Schmidt boxes with their carefully labeled specimens. If she could share rent with Doris, and if she lived as frugally as she usually did, she calculated that her money could tide her over for at least 6 months. She imagined walking streets with names she'd never heard. She imagined anonymous edifices, monuments, milky stone and plate glass. No coppery water's edge smell. No cord grass or cattails or cormorants. Despite her indifference to Doris, when Edith heard her familiar, chirpy voice on the phone saying, "Yes, good gracious, come," affection for the woman seized her so that she could barely eke out a thank you. Once there, Edith avoided the Potomac as best she could, glad that the famous cherry trees wouldn't tempt her, having relinquished their clouds of blossom to the tidal basin mud months earlier. Skirting the monuments, which struck her as forbidding, she immersed herself in art, something her father had never cared for, some days wandering distractedly through the galleries, catching mere color and shape with her peripheral vision, other days standing before a single painting for so long she seemed to enter it, the world around her dimming, the conversation blurring to hum. Although her father had never taken her to church, she felt most moved by the religious paintings, Mary's deep blue robes and whisper-frail hands in Van Eyck's Annunciation, the peacock perched like an angel on the stable roof, a kneeling man touching, with heartbreaking gentleness, the tiny foot of Christ in the adoration of the Magi Tondo. But after 2 weeks, despite her better judgment, the Natural History Building drew her irresistibly. Even so, she scrupulously kept to the unfamiliar. Stegosaurus skeleton like a giant puzzle. Lions and giraffes looking startlingly alive that Teddy Roosevelt had brought back from his African expedition. The great fossil whale, Basilosaurus, suspended from the ceiling in the Hall of Extinct Monsters. And then, despite all her carefulness, to be undone by little white rectangles in glass cases. When her knees buckled, he caught her. It was no cinematic swoon. She did not arch like a willow branch or rest lightly in his arms like a bouquet of lilies. She went down hard and sudden, and he hooked her under the armpits, so roughly it left bruises, just before she hit the floor. If she had had the capacity for anything but sorrow, she would have been mortified by the sounds she'd made, primitive and raw and racking, as if every pent-up sob from the last month had torn itself free from the center of her body. He half-carried, half-dragged her to a bench, and she turned toward him and shuddered against his chest, her fists gripping and ungripping the fabric of his shirt. His arms went around her as automatically as a mother's, but he didn't stroke or pat or press her to him. He simply held until her weeping stammered, guttered, and went out, finally, all at once, like a flame. Then he let go. She drew away, leaned backward against the bench, and laid the backs of her hands against her closed eyes. When she could speak, she meant to apologize, but what came out instead was, "What a way to begin." A fact that would only mortify her later that evening, and that she would chalk up to being shaken and confused. Joseph would always insist that she knew somehow, on some gut level, and she would argue that, with all her vast inexperience, she was the last person to instinctively recognize love. Still, it was odd. But there in the museum, Joseph didn't point out the oddness or tell her not to think twice about falling into his arms like a sack of rocks. He handed her his handkerchief and said, "I think we should go see the Lincoln Memorial." And maybe because she was too exhausted or too startled, or maybe, as Joseph forever believed, it was because she acknowledged, without knowing why or how, the inevitability of them, she said, "Well, yes, all right. I haven't seen it yet." In the cool, pale, columned space, with Lincoln watching over them, noble as God, but still touchingly human with his crooked tie and open coat, like a man resting for a moment on a park bench or in an armchair, she found her grief rearranging itself, moving to the edges of her mind enough for her to begin to speak, more calmly than she could have imagined possible even an hour ago. She talked about her father, his life and death, and Joseph listened.
Chapter 4. Claire. Almost before I knew it was Zack, I knew he was stressed. It was there in his bouncing half-jog, the way he brandished a giant bouquet like a sword over his head. It flickered around him like an aura. And even though stressed was much too mild a word for what Zack was, for the state that could overtake him like a fever, it was the one we always used. As the child of a bipolar parent, even one as successfully medicated as my mother, I sometimes wondered whether Zack's moodiness was something more than moodiness. The one time I'd tried to gently broach the subject, he'd snapped at me and then deflated to a blank sadness that lasted so long I'd finally apologized, almost entirely sincerely, and taken back what I'd said, much less sincerely, and I never mentioned it again. But the way he'd pull vivacity over the surface of his anxiety like a crazily colored tarp never quite stopped freaking me out. For instance, I knew that when he got near enough for me to see him in detail, his cheeks would be fuchsia, his eyes bright, his hands restless, his laugh full of blazing sunshine. He would possibly make an extravagant gesture like dropping to one knee to present me with the flowers. He would almost definitely call me gorgeous. And I'd be torn, as always, between wanting to run far, far away and wanting to wrap him in my arms and keep him safe forever. Zack didn't drop to one knee. Instead, he caught me up in a hug that lifted me clean off the ground and spun me around, no easy feat, since at 5'9", I'm a mere 2 inches shorter than he is. The spinning made me feel ridiculous, like an actress in a gum commercial. But once I was back on the ground, to make up for not appreciating his romantic gesture, I nestled my face into his neck and kissed it.
"Hey, gorgeous,"
he said, pulling back a couple of inches and grinning so hard a muscle twitched in his cheek. With one finger, I touched the twitching spot. "Hello, you," I said. He handed me the bouquet.
"I realize giving you flowers right now is like bringing coals to Newcastle, but I wanted you to have your favorite.
Favorite. Before I even glanced down into the heavy, brown paper, ribbon-tied cone, I knew what I would find. And sure enough, there they were. 24 waxy blooms.